Rav Peretz Manash, who's from Beit Ha'ilit, he's in Rosh Cholo there, who will share. Baruch Hashem, I met tonight for the first time in person. He's been good enough to assist Jerusalem Kosher News for quite some time. I think he was the first Rav who volunteered his services, and his experience and knowledge in Kosher has written several articles for those who follow. And Baruch Hashem, because of tonight, we got to meet in person finally. Anyway, I'd like to lechvod Amor Da'aswa and the Tzibur to introduce Rav Manash, who will speak about kashering, agola, commercial, industrial, and we'll go from there.
It's an honor and a pleasure to be here tonight to share with you some information about kashers in general. And especially my main goal is there's not going to be enough time to cover every single detail of all the intricacies of Hagolas Kalim and Kashering, but I mainly want to give an understanding of the logic underpinning the Halachas of Kashers. So then, whatever we don't cover, you'll be able to a certain degree, figure out on your own. And at least you'll be able to ask Kasheilas Chacham. I just want to give an introduction, a hakdama, that my main goal here is not to say practical halacha l'maises. That's each individual shaila that comes up. A person has to ask their rav, and especially I understand here we have a very capable rav, and the shaila that come up l'maises, people should ask their rav. But I want to give an understanding of the basics so that people will know what to ask and how to ask. So I think we're going to start with the basics, with the very basics of Hagolas Kalim. The starting point is, obviously, there are certain foods that are treif, that are aser to eat, which could be many different things. It could be a behemoth that's a treif or a nevela. It could be peiros that are tevel. There's many things that could be aser. The Torah asers eating the object itself. The Gemara learns out that there is a concept of tam ki ikar. Even if one doesn't eat the actual object that's treif, however, eating the flavor of it, if say it was cooked together, let's say someone took treif and meat and cooked it with potatoes, now the potatoes have a flavor from treif and meat, so the potatoes are also aser to eat, and that's called tam ki ikar, that the flavor has the same halacha as its origin. The maskot, the machlek is rishayim, but the maskon of Shulchan Aruch is that tam ki ikar is a din doraisa. So if someone would eat that potato that has tam basar in it, he's over in Isser Daraisa. Not only do potatoes absorb flavor, but kalim, utensils, vessels, pots, spoons, also can absorb flavor. Therefore, if someone cooked something that was not kosher in a pot, or in a kosher pot, or if he, say, stuck his spoon into the pot that was cooking non-kosher food, or if it spilled on his countertop, or it was cooked in his microwave oven, or whatever the example may be, we're concerned that now it has imparted a non-kosher flavor into this pot, spoon, microwave oven, whatever the case may be. And we have to remove it, because if you would then go and cook a different kosher food in this pot, or stir it with a spoon again, etc., it would now acquire this non-kosher flavor. And then it would be also midaraisa even to eat this second kosher food, previously kosher food. The makor for this is from two different places in the Torah. We learn at number one from Milchemes Midyon, that after the Yidden made a milchama against Midyon, and after the maisa of Baal Pa'ar, so then Hashem told Moshe Rabbeinu to tell the Yidden that all of the kalim, all of the pots that they captured from the Midyonim, they have to kasher. They have to either burn them in fire or boil them in water. Whatever thing it's appropriate halach, as we'll get to soon. But you have to clean out the pots, not just clean them, but you have to remove the bliyos, the absorbed flavors that are in them. Additionally, regarding karbonos, it says that if someone cooked a carbon in a pot, if it's the pot has to be cleaned out from the bliyos. Either if it's washed out with hot water, if it's a kli charis, it has to be broken. So we see from two different places in the Torah that if a kli absorbs flavor that is not kosher, that's treif for whatever reason, that's osur, so then the pot, the bliyos, the flavor must be removed from the pot before the pot is used again for kosher food. There are two main different ways of removing tam, two which are also three really, but main ways of removing the tam from these utensils. The first way is hagola. Hagola would mean immersing something in boiling water. What does that accomplish? The same way the flavor went in when the food was cooked in the pot, what happened? Someone, let's say, cooked trefa meat in a pot with water. So the flavor was came out of the meat as it was cooked, and some of that flavor was absorbed in the walls of the pot. Next time one would cook in the pot, so the water and the new food would remove some of the flavor because there's a constant transfer of flavor in and out of the pot. When one does hagala, when we put water in the pot and we boil the pot, that it's actually bubbling, so that is assumed that it removes all of the flavor that's in the pot. All of the tam, all of the flavor, both the trefa flavor and whatever kosher flavor may have been in the walls of that pot, will now come out into the water. We've now removed the flavor from the pot. The problem is, where's the flavor? It's now in the water. Now, the pot's still in the water. If it was a spoon, you put the spoons in the water. That tam is going to go back in. So there's a couple of conditions we're going to need to make sure that the pot will remain kosher and will not become treif again. But the basic understanding of Hagola is that by boiling water in the pot, we remove the tam iser from the pot. Now, in order to affect this, as we mentioned, the water has to be, pashtus of Shulchan Aruch is the water has to be actually boiling. There is a machlokes, there are those who are mekel, but for now, lechatchila, certainly the water should be physically, actually boiling, and a rolling boil, not just little bubbles, but a strong boil. Certainly, if the water is boiling, that is sufficient. In certain cases, it will be a kula if the water is boiling. What case would that be? There's some cases where the original bli in the pot may have been at a hotter temperature than boiling. Now you'll ask, how could that be? Because water can only exist in a liquid form up to 100 degrees Celsius under normal circumstances. So how did the blis go in hotter than 100 degrees? So there's a couple possibilities here. Let's say it was a deep fryer that became treif. Oil boils at a much hotter temperature than water. So the blis may have gone in at 110, 120 degrees Celsius. You're now boiling water that's only 100 degrees Celsius. But still, we accept that boiling water will remove all of the blis. Another example would be a pressure cooker. When the water is under pressure, it will remain in liquid form considerably above 100 degrees Celsius. The blis may have gone in hotter. It's not necessary to do hagola in a pressure cooker. A hagola can be done in a regular pot that's boiling. A third, maybe more nitpicky difference would be, let's say someone cooked the isra in the pot in Bnei Brak at sea level. Then he brought the pot to Yerushalayim, which is 700-800 meters above sea level. There's less air pressure, water will boil. I don't know the exam, but say 99, 98 degrees Celsius, because there's less air pressure. So when you're doing a gola, it's not going to be the same temperature that the pot absorbed the tam iser. That's still okay. Boiling water always removes all of the tam from the pot. What's going to be, though, if you created a vacuum in your pot? There are certain circumstances commercially where to save themselves energy, rather than save them their heating costs, they'll create a vacuum in the pot. And therefore, the water will boil at a much, much lower temperature. It might be 60 degrees Celsius, it might even be 40 degrees Celsius. One example where this is commonly done, which isn't really our topic today, is when they extract salt from seawater. They'll do it in multiple pots where each one is a lower and lower pressure and therefore lower and lower temperature. The seventh pot, you often use six or seven, can be boiled. Water can be boiling at 30 or 40 degrees Celsius, which is not even Yad Soledis. So really what that's relevant for is the question of Bishlach or Bishl on Shabbos, which is not our topic. But in such a case, it's accepted in the Paiskim that less than Yad Soledis is certainly not going to do Hagol. What's going to be between Yad Soledis and, let's say, 95, 98 degrees, that's not clear in the Paiskim where the borderline is. But you could do hagola in a pot in Yerushalayim, even if it was cooked by Bnei Brak or even in Yamamah. That is accepted. We don't have to be medactic that it should be the same altitude. Fine. Another, the other way mentioned in the Torah of doing removing the blias from a pot is libun. Libun means burning it, putting it in a fire. When does this need to be This is obviously a more difficult and also a stronger way of cleaning out the pot. When is this necessary? It can always be done. Something that needs Hagolah, where it was boiled in the... Hagolah is required, is usually used when something, when the Isra was boiled in a liquid. And in that case, Hagolah is sufficient. But let's say the Isra was roasted on a barbecue, for example. So then, since the Blias went directly, under a more intense heat, without the intermediary, without the medium of a liquid, so then Libun is required. And Libun would be a blowtorch, or potentially a self-cleaning oven, certainly a matzah oven. It's generally accepted it has to get, for Libun Chamor, it must get up to about 900 degrees Celsius. 900 degrees Fahrenheit, I'm sorry. When it which the Gemara refers to as Mitzaytzayz Nitaz, that sparks will fly out of it. At that temperature, we assume that any blias inside the kli are completely burned up, and they no longer exist. They're turned to a crisp, they're burned out, there are no blias isser left in the pot. There's a second form of libun which can be done, which is more lenient, it's called libun kal. This can be done, number one, on something that requires, that really only needs hagolah, but for various reasons it's not practical to do hagolah. Let's say it's too large to fit in the pot. Let's say it's difficult to clean, as we'll mention soon. So then there's certain cases where libun kal can be done. Another case would be if the pot batsman is heter. I want to transfer it from milchut to fleishig, but it's kosher. So there, to transfer from milchut to fleishig, I don't really need to get out all the blias. I only need to weaken the blias enough that it won't create an iser of baser b'chalav. For that, I can use a lower intensity heat. That needs what the Gemara Shani referred to as kash nisraf me'achayruf. If a straw meaning like a blade of grass, not a drinking straw, will be placed on the opposite side of the, let's say, metal from where the heat source is, it would burst into flame. We know the kindling point of paper is roughly 450 degrees Fahrenheit, so it's generally accepted about 450, 500 degrees Fahrenheit is hot enough on the opposite side, that that's called libun kal. So those are basically the two, three types of kashering that can be done. There's hagolah, there's libun kal, and there's libun chomer. What are the differences? So as we mentioned, libun chomer burns up the blias. Hagolah removes the blias into the liquid. Libun kal is a machlekes what it does. If it removes the blias, if it draws them out, or if it burns them up inside the pot. And there will be significant differences how you understand them. One specific nafkamina, one difference that comes out of this havana would be that since hagolah, as we mentioned before, we have an issue with hagolah. We've taken the blias out of the pot, but where are they? They're in the water. The blias, as the pot's hot, will go back into the... Though the blias that are in the water, the isser in the water, will go back into the pot. So how have you kashered your pot? So we said we were going to address it. Let's address that. Hagolah is going to require one of two things. Either the water will have to be at least 60 times the volume of, let's say, the spoon you're kashering. That way, even if the spoon was full of blias, the entire volume of the spoon, let's say the spoon was 1 cubic centimeter, so a maximum couldn't have more than a cubic centimeter of tam isser in it. Probably is much, much less. But we're always going to be concerned about the worst case scenario. Worst comes to worst, there's 1 cubic centimeter of tam isser in the spoon. If there's more than 60 cc's of water in the pot I'm using for hagolah, so it would be bottle b'shisha. So even if the spoon was full of tam isser, but all that tamisr came into the water, it's now batel b'shishim, the water is not osur. So even now, as the water circulates and goes back into the spoon, but the spoon will remain kosher. That's one way of getting out of the problem. The second way of getting out of the problem is to do hagolah on a spoon or pot that has not been used for treif for at least 24 hours, called einoy ben yoymoy. Why does that work? Because we only say tam ki'ikr, we're only concerned about a flavor when there's a flavor by itself. There's no actual tarfus here. There's no actual isser here. There's only the flavor of isser. Now it only concerns us if it's going to impart a positive flavor into the previously kosher food. If it's going to make it taste bad, then it doesn't concern me. So for example, common example would be, waiter, there's a fly in my soup. Right? So obviously you don't want the fly. You take out the fly. Flies are awesome. But what about the soup? Do I need to make sure there's 60 times the volume of the fly in my soup? The answer is no. Because a fly is assumed that it gives a bad flavor to the soup. It doesn't give a good flavor to the soup. Right? Certainly people would not want the fly in their soup. So, therefore, I'm not worried about the flavor of the fly in my soup. It's, if there's not 60 times the volume of the fly in my soup, the fly may have, in fact, imparted flavor in my soup. But since it's negative, it doesn't make the soup awesome. There's a general rule, a general assumption, that any tam that's in a pot for 24 hours, in a kli for 24 hours, is going to be stale, and it's going to impart a negative flavor in whatever else is cooked in that pot. So if I've waited 24 hours since the spoon or the pot became treif before I kosher it, whatever flavor goes from the pot or spoon into the hot water is going to be a negative flavor. It's not going to make the water asur, and therefore I'm not worried when that flavor goes back into the pot. So you'll ask me though, I don't understand. If it can't make it asur, so why did I have to kosher the pot at all? Because the pot itself, even like, let's say I wouldn't have kashered the pot, and would have gone and made a vegetable soup in this pot that yesterday I by mistake cooked treifa meat in. So what's wrong with the vegetable soup? The vegetable soup's not going to be awesome, because the pot only gave a negative. You're right, the pot may have given a taste of meat, which was treifa meat, into my vegetable soup, but it made the vegetable soup taste worse because the meat was stale. The tam yisr was beina ben yaymai, it was old. So the answer is midaraisa, you're right. Midaraisa, if I would have cooked vegetable soup in my 24-hour-old pot, the vegetable soup would not become asur. However, it's asur l'chatchila midrabonon to cook in a treifa pot, even if it's only going to give a negative tam. So therefore, I have to do agol. However, since the tam comes out, and now it can't make the water asur midaraisa midiavid, so now what's going to go back into the pot is going to be two steps removed from the original iser. So it's called not barnat, and it's not barnat de heteru. So it's two steps removed from the original iser, and it's now, it's according to the letter of the law, it's mutter. So since it's indirect tam of heter, we're not concerned about it anymore. So that's the two ways of making hagola work. It's always going to have to be that the pot or utensil either is at least 24 hours have passed since you last used it for treif, or alternatively, you have to ensure that there's at least 60 times the volume of the utensil in the liquid, in the water. Fine. So now we've gotten over those limitations. We understand that. Now that is only going to be relevant as we were, this is how we got onto it, because agola is removing the flavor into the water. However, liban, which just burns up the flavor, does not have either of these two limitations. There's no need for any 60 times anything of the spoon or the pot, because I don't need to be mevatel, I don't need bittel on the tam. And additionally, I don't have to even wait 24 hours, because I'm burning up the tam. There will be no tam left when I've finished my liban. So neither of those two things will apply. It has to be in there for a couple of seconds. There's no, it can't be in and out in a second. It has to be enough time that the bleus could come out. We don't know exactly how long that is, but we generally assume that when it's boiling, when it's a rolling boil, that a couple seconds is enough time. There's no specific, I can't tell you 5 seconds, 10 seconds, but it shouldn't be in and out in a second. It doesn't have to be there a long time. Okay.
Sure. Well, when something becomes tray, yes. If there's no time limit, even if it doesn't touch it for a second.
Right. If the iser touched the head for the pot for a second, you put your spoon in it. Look, to guys. Right. We're going to assume that the spoon.
Scenario, everything.
Right. something went in and we don't know how much, so we'll worry about the worst case scenario that maybe it totally saturated itself with the iser, and it has to, we need shishim against the whole thing. Even though, yes, you're right, practically speaking, it's not likely, but we're always midrabbanan, we have to be worried about the worst case scenario. Could you, let's say you had a long, let's say a ladle, and it doesn't fit in your pot, can you do half and another half? Yes. Sorry. So he asked if Hagola can be done half and half. Let's say I have a long ladle and I want to do Hagola on it in a relatively short pot. So can I do half of the ladle, take it out, and do the other half? The answer is yes. However, I should just point out there's a qualification that in between the two halves, you should rinse off the ladle and dry it before putting in the second half. Why is that? Because there may be droplets of water on the ladle that are the issa that came out, so you want to rinse those off. And we want to dry it so that any droplets of water remaining won't cool off the boiling water. Fine. So now there's another important rule in kashering, and that's kiboiloi kach poltoi. The way the tam went in is the way it has to come out. This explains why we mentioned previously that hagola is required on something that absorbed through cooking, and liban is required on something that absorbed tam through roasting. If the tam went in with a liquid, it can come out with a liquid. If it went in through a dry, direct heat of the fire, it can only come out through a dry, direct heat of the fire. Just reiterate what we mentioned previously, since libun is stronger, if it absorbed tam through bishul, through boiling, it can be kashered through libun. It's just not necessary. There are certain cases where one may think it absorbed tam through a liquid. For example, a frying pan, where we generally, the Rambam, at least after the minhag of Ashkenazim, is to require libun. But that's because we're concerned that it may be that the oil evaporated or was absorbed in the food, and there was direct contact between the food and the pot and the frying pan without the intervention of oil. Yeah, so for example, that would not apply to a deep fryer, only to a frying pan. So that's the classic example of kiboilei kach poltei, the method which the tam went into the pot, whether dry or liquid, is the same method by which it must come out. Furthermore, if tam went in through a kli rishon, let's say it was in through a pot that was on the fire, someone cooked a pot on the fire by mistake with treif meat in it, then the only way to do agola is with a boiling pot that is on the flame, on the fire itself. However, let's say the pot of treif of food spilled onto something, so now it was iuri kli rishon, it was only poured from a kli rishon. So then hagola can be done by pouring on this treif object from boiling water in a pot. If the bliya was only through a kli sheni, then it's enough to do hagola in a kli sheni. It's generally best to do everything in a kli rishon, and it's the most straightforward way of doing it. However, the halacha is, the way it went in is the way it comes out. Now there's a question: how far do we extend this rule? The way it went, kibayle kach poltei. The way it went in is the way it came out. Will that also apply to temperatures? Now, as we mentioned previously, certainly the chumra, if it went in through a deep frying of hot oil that was hotter than 100 degrees Celsius, it's not necessary to do agola with hot oil. It's sufficient to do with boiling water that's going to be cooler than the tam went in. And also we mentioned with air pressure and pressure cookers and whatever. I'm sorry?
How much Celsius?
Boiling oil? I don't know exactly, but oil boils at a significantly hotter temperature than water. I don't know if it's 110 or 120 degrees Celsius. But if you deep fry treif of meat in your pot, in your deep fryer, it's enough to kasher it with water that's boiling at 100 degrees Celsius. You don't have to boil oil at 110, 120 degrees Celsius. Reb Moshe says that it is sufficient, in Igros Moshe, that it's sufficient to apply this by agola also to the temperature. Let's say I would know that this pot absorbed the tam iser at 80 degrees Celsius. It would not be necessary, would not be essential to boil it, to kasher it at 100 degrees Celsius at a rolling boil. It would be enough to raise it above, to fill it with water and raise the temperature above 80 degrees Celsius. And if it went in at 80 degrees Celsius, it will come out at 80 degrees Celsius. Everything that went in will come out. Under certain circumstances, the OU does rely on this. There's some times where you have machinery where it's not practical, it's very difficult to get it up to 100 degrees Celsius. For example, let's say you have a machinery with lots of piping, and it's carrying whatever, let's say pasteurized milk from a holding tank to the heat exchanger, which is where it's brought up to pasteurizing temperature, which is close to boiling. But then, it goes from there to other tanks, it goes through piping to the other side of the mixture, which will cool it down, and it goes through numerous piping, all of which, much of which will be Yad Tzeila display. It may even go to a holding tank while it's still Yad Tzeila display. Now, that means, say, the piping in the holding tank only may have come in contact with milk at 80 degrees Celsius, 60 degrees Celsius, 50 degrees Celsius, which is Yad Tzeila display. So it's hot enough that the flavor would have been absorbed in the walls. However, since the heating element, the direct application of heat when you want to kasher it, is only going to be at one point, and all of these pipes are only going to be receiving heat further down the line, they're not going to get to 100 degrees Celsius when you boil it. So under certain circumstances, Reb Moshe B'Shas HaDechak does allow that. No, you, again, under certain circumstances, will permit this. It seems to be accepted by numerous Vadei Kashrus. Lemaisa is, Pashas Shulchan Aruch does say that Hagola must only be done at least L'chatchila at water that is a rolling boil. And it must remain a rolling boil even when you, let's say, for example, you're putting a smaller pot into a large pot, it's going to cool off. And it may have been a rolling boil before you put in the smaller pot, but it's going to cool off and it will stop boiling. You do have to leave it in long enough that it will resume boiling and be there a couple seconds before you take out the pot. Because at least l'chatchila, the water, Shulchan Aruch says the water must be a rolling boil. So there are circumstances, b'shas hadchak, where we can be meikel on kebayle kach poltai, but l'chatchila, the water must be a rolling boil. Yes.
So, if you're doing Haggadah, and you put something else in, can you add a piece of iron that's hot to make it boil? Is that...
You could do that, it's generally not necessary. If we're talking about a pot...
No, because to wait for it to boil
right.
is longer. If you have a hot piece of iron, right. Now they burn it, and you just put it in, and that makes it boil. And that's
if it's really boiling, as long as it's not really bubbles perfect. From the piece being thrown in, yes.
Okay.
Yes. Theoretically, you could. It wouldn't be practical. I mean, if this is whatever the factory is, if it's producing, whatever it's producing, if it's meant, if it's built to work on hot, it's not going to have anything to do with it on cold. So it would not generally be done. What is potentially done under, again, not l'chatchila, but b'shas hadchak, is, as we mentioned, if you wait 24, why does waiting 24 hours work? Because now it's nice and tam lefgam. The flavor it gives off will be a negative flavor. Let's say you could run through the system hot water mixed with ammonium or some other noxious chemical that will impart a non-positive or negative flavor to the machinery and any bleus that would come out. So then, again, under certain circumstances, we can't allow Hagola without waiting 24 hours because it'll be nice and tam lefgam without it. There's a lot of details of why it's not an ideal situation, but under certain circumstances it can be done. But running cold, I don't think, would be in general practical.
Sorry, the pot is too big to put into another pot. So what do you boil it up until the water runs over?
Usually, so what you'll do is you'll the larger pot you'll fill, not to the top. Assume the larger pot will be a kosher pot. You'll put it on the fire till it starts boiling. Once it's a rolling boil, you'll throw in the smaller pot. You'll place it out.
So why don't you chafe the big pot?
If you chafe the big pot, okay. We can get to there now. We can mention that now since you brought it up. I don't have a specific other good place to mention it. The halacha, what the Gemara says you do with an extremely large pot is that you build up with clay or with dough a lip around. The problem with the pot, big pot, simple, let's go. The starting thing, the simplest thing to do should be fill it to the top, boil it, and now that's how it absorbed. It absorbed from the inside. You should be able to take it out by boiling water inside. The problem is going to be the lip. The lip inevitably was splashed, was splattered on when it was originally cooking. If you just boil the pot for 5 minutes, how do you know it's going to specifically splatter on every point where it originally absorbed the isser from? So that's problematic. So the Gemara says to build up a lip of clay or dough. The Gemara says dough, but for Pesach you're not going to use dough, you're going to use, you'd use clay around the lip. So now I can fill it all the way to the top and a little bit above the natural lip of the pot. And then I boil it above that lip. The Pesach can give a different case, which a different solution, which they say is a better solution, is to fill it to the top, bring it to a boil, and then, as the lady mentioned before, is to take a red-hot rock or piece of metal and drop it in, that it will overflow all around the sides of the lip. Now, to do that, there's still a couple parts. So the advantage of that is that now I know that I've had a flow of water all around the lip. Of course, that requires the pot being completely level and carefully lowering in this object that is not just going to splash over one side or the other. Now, so those two are surmountable problems, but there's a couple other difficulties with it. Number one is just practically, when you're splashing that much boiling water, it can be dangerous. So it's not practically recommended for danger reasons. Another problem is that if the pot had originally, it's certainly possible that the pot had received splatters of isser on the outside. If it was splattered on the outside, so the hagol on the inside does not necessarily remove all of those bleas, and you would want a kasher from the outside also. Now, when it overflows, it's not reliably going to cover the entire outer. It may cover the whole lip, it won't reliably cover the entire outer surface of the pot. So you could potentially kasher the inside of the pot that way, and then do irui. You could pour from a boiling pot on the outside, or you could do libun on the outside, or you could do libun on the whole pot once you're at it. Or I would even suggest is, I don't know the arrangements in Beit Shemesh, but I know in Beit Tao where I live, there are certain places where once a month, usually Erev Shabbos Mevarchim, they have a communal Hagolas Kelim, and there they'll have a huge pot set up for Hagola, and it might be worth waiting till then. If you can't wait, so then you'll have to find a different solution. But theoretically, you can boil over the pot. For practical reasons, it is not always it's not always ideal.
Or you're taking a specific case where...
I'm just saying, practically speaking, if you know it, if you cooked on the inside, you don't necessarily have to be worried.
It's not,
if I don't see the
wall of the pot isn't one thing from inside to outside, then you don't have to worry about the outside?
If you know that it's splattered on the outside, if you know it's splattered on the outside, you should do hagol on the outside also. Okay.
I didn't
understand it that way, but if that is the question, so we'll answer that. Well, if that wasn't his question, so now it's your question. As long as we'd waited 24 hours and there was or there was at least 60 times the volume of the smaller pot in the water, it is not necessary to kasher the outer pot. Should ideally be kashered. If you want it to remain, to go back to being milchuk, it should be kashered in a pot that is of the same, whatever you want to call it, same category as the same gender is what you want the pot to be when you're finished.
recommend making this red hot stone?
I personally, if you don't have experience doing it, I'm not sure if it's recommended because it's dangerous. But the simple, if you want to do it, the best, what I've seen done is using a good tongs to put it on, if you, on a different gas burner on the gas range. Turn up the gas and place it, if it's on the burner, it will get very, very hot. It doesn't have to be red hot. The main thing is, in this case specifically, what I really want to do is I want to make the large pot overflow, and I don't want to put in something cold that will cool off the water that will stop boiling. So it doesn't have to be specifically red hot. We're not doing libud on the stone or on the piece of metal. The point is it should be something that's going to cause it to overflow without cooling it down.
Would it be possible to take, instead of a stone, take a smaller pot, put it on a burner, and let it get very hot from the bottom, and use that to insert into the pot to cause it to overflow?
It's a practical concern. If that would work, you know, you don't want to ruin your pot by putting it empty on a fire. And it has to be hot enough that when you put it in...
I had some liquid in there. I filled it part of the way, so I won't ruin the pot.
Probably if you have a liquid that'll keep the temperature of the walls of the pot down,
I'll get the liquid inside to boil.
Right.
And I'll be in, so I'll put on the fire for 10 minutes or so, 5, 10 minutes, whatever it is. The inside liquid is boiling. The bottom of the pot is hot because it's been sitting straight on the burner. Mm-hmm. And immediately taken... inserted into this pot that I'm trying to kasher and use that to cause the overflow.
Theoretically, there's no problem. If it'll make it overflow without stopping boiling, it'll be fine. You just have to make sure that the practicalities are worked out that that's going to happen. Yes?
I just went to the hardware store and asked them for a piece of, that was in America, asked them for a piece of iron. They bent it in an L so it would stand, and I stood on the burner and I took the pliers. Okay. And that was easier to control because you could just
rock.
Hold it.
Okay.
In a rock.
Yeah, very good. Piece of metal will work perfectly fine. Okay. Now, since we mentioned that you need kibbalei kachpoltoi, so with hagolah, and the way hagolah works is that it's removing the tam from the pot by the contact of the liquid, so there are certain issues that come up. One, Rav Moshe Me'az was asked, can Hagolah be done with steam? Will steam remove the blias? And Rav Moshe is very reluctant. Rav Moshe says we can't rely on steam. At least part of the reason is because you don't have that contact with liquid. You have steam hitting it and going on. It's not necessarily going to remove, because what Hagolah has to do is has to remove all of the tam from the pot. It's not necessarily going to do that. What Rav Moshe does say can be done, though, is if you're using a, what they call a steam jenny, or here I guess a kitoran, if you steam it so long that the outside becomes covered with a film of water, and then you keep doing it till the steam causes that water to boil, that will at least be like a hagola in water. You'll be doing hagola in the film of water, not in the steam itself. But to do hagola in steam is not posh. It's not, Rav Moshe does not allow doing that. Which then creates a halacha issue besides the practical issue with kashering microwave ovens. Microwave ovens is something everyone always asks about, kashering microwave ovens and using them for milchugs and fleishigs, or someone who works, let's say, in a not from office, if they can use the office microwave to heat up their food. So there's a couple considerations. Number one is, theoretically, if you double bag your food would be great, and it would work, except that the teva is, the way microwaves work is, that they work on the moisture that's in the food, and they create a lot of steam. As the steam rises off the food, it creates a lot of pressure. It's very likely to burst the bag, or to open the bag, or to rip the bag, and then you'll end up with all the steam coming out, and you haven't accomplished anything by double wrapping your food. So number one is you've got a practical problem with double wrapping. So I personally would not recommend someone use a microwave for milchugs and fleishigs double wrapping, or use a tray for microwave with wrapping. Another consideration would be, let's say the microwave did become tray for, I want to switch it. So the question is, can I do a gola? I'll wait 24 hours, I'll clean the inside of the microwave, and I'll put in a cup or a bowl of water, turn it on high long enough for the pot to boil, and to cup to boil and fill the whole microwave with steam, and you should say kiboilei kach potai. But there's a couple problems. Number one is that I would think the most analogous case to this that's mentioned in Shulchan Aruch would be the lid of a pot. The lid of a pot is absorbing tam through steam. How do you kasher the lid of a pot? Not just by putting it on top of a boiling pot. You have to immerse it in a kli rishon itself. You have to do agolin kli rishon. So, l'chayra, the most analogous case to the microwave, it's not enough to just steam it up, you have to boil it. As Reb Moshe mentioned, because steam is not a simple way of doing agola. It's not necessarily going to draw out all of the tam. It will draw out some tam. So therefore, the steam that rises will absorb some tam from the roof of the microwave. As it fills up with a cloud of steam, it will bring it back down to the food, and it may impart that tam into your food and make the food awesome. But it's not necessarily going to draw out all of the tam to kasher. So that's number one, a halacha issue with kashering a microwave. Beyond that, there's a practical issue. Is even if you scrub your microwave clean and you can get in all the cracks and crevices, which is necessary always before doing hagola to make sure it's completely clean, but there's almost all microwaves I've seen have holes in the back that lead to a fan that draws out the air to circulate the air. There's no way you're going to be able to clean the fan blades that are behind that, behind those holes, behind that grate. And you certainly could have had trefa steam that was drawn through the holes and then adhered or caused bleus inside there, which you won't be able to practically clean out. So it's another reason why, practically speaking, I personally do not recommend cleaning microwaves, kashering microwaves, and using them either for milchigs and fleishigs or using a tray for microwave. Yeah.
With the double bag, if you make a small hole, and let's say steam does come out, has a little hole, but the steam is going out, not in. Would that help?
You're right. Let's say the story came the other way. Let's say someone came and said, you know, I made a mistake. I tried double bagging my food, and the bag burst. And I right away noticed it and turned off the microwave. Or let's say there was a small hole and steam was escaping. So now what's the concern? The concern was, did enough steam hit that it can draw out the tam and come back to the food? There is room to, if such a thing happens, there's room to ask a rav, and it may be that the rav will be matter. However, I wouldn't recommend that as something you'd want to be doing l'chatchila on a daily basis. My opinion, I wouldn't recommend it l'chatchila. Happen b'di'evit, ask a rav, and you may be able to, the rav may say it's motor, but I wouldn't recommend it. Yeah.
Experience, usually the size of the microwave usually don't reach Yatzalas, even though the food's extremely hot.
Right.
I tried putting my hand in, touching the sides, and it was in that, so in that situation, see if you've seen that,
so you still have the consideration of, sorry, the question was that if the walls of the microwave do not become very hot, so then can one assume that the microwave never became treif? Because the liquid, whatever hit the microwave was cool enough that it would not... Tam flavor is only imparted when something is above the temperature of Yad Soilet display. It has to be hot enough that the hand recoils from it. If the walls of the microwave don't get above that temperature, so maybe there's no bleus at all. That's a good question. I was really talking about kashering microwaves. This still remains the practical issue that I mentioned of the fan blades could have on them actual particles of trefa food. That issue would certainly remain. I have personal experience found that sometimes if the food is moist enough and you left it in long enough, the roof of the microwave can get Yad Soiledis blades. So if it didn't get Yad Soiledis, it could be that you wouldn't have a problem. But again, I wouldn't recommend that as something you'd want to be doing on a regular basis. If there's a shas at chak or whatever, ask your rav. But I would not recommend that on a daily basis.
So yes. When somebody says you can kasher a microwave with boiling
Or they're saying that you're going to have enough liquid that the roof of the oven got coated with water and then the steam reboiled that water, would be potentially. But or else they're not going liquid mush. Yes.
Why in general, when you talk about foods double wrapping, why did you say double wrapping?
It's a good question, but I have enough. I put it this way. I'd like to finish on time. I'm happy to answer you afterwards. I want to finish on time because I don't think I have enough material. I could speak for 3 hours probably. I'm sure no one here wants to sit for 3 hours. I believe neither will not go much over my hour. So not more than 5 minutes, I hope. So I want to address side points. What? I should answer? Okay. Fine. Fine? Okay. If there's a single...
First, repeat the question.
Sure. The question was, why do people mention double bagging things? And not, why wouldn't a single bag be enough? In this case, with a microwave, it would only be a practical consideration that one bag would be more likely to open than a double bag. The reason double bagging is often mentioned is because, let's say I have something in a single bag, and it's coming in direct contact with something trafe, so the trafe will go through to the other side just like it would a pot. So if something trafe touched the outside of a pot, the food inside the pot will absorb flavor through the wall and the food will become trafe. If there's a single bag, so the flavor can go, a classic case would be an airplane meal. Airplane meals are all double bagged, double wrapped, because they're heated in the same oven as the trafe meals. Why? Because if steam from the trafe meals or residue from a trafe meal would touch a single bag, so now that bag would be osir, and any food touching the inside of that bag would also become osir. Because flavor, tam, is imparted through a kli to what's touching it on the inside. However, tam does not go from one kli to another kli if there is no food or liquid in between them. So if you have a double bag, so the outside bag will become treif. If, let's say, in your airplane meal, the outer wrapping is now treif, but it can't make the inner wrapping treif. So now the food that's touching the inner wrapping will stay kosher. And the outer wrapping should not be used. You should not let hot food touch the outer wrapping of your airplane meal. But in the microwave oven case, it would really only be a practical consideration. Okay. There is... Okay, let's get on to some important... There's a very important... So we mentioned the Hagala, we mentioned passing, but we have to emphasize, before Hagala, the pot must be spotlessly clean. It's very important. If it's something that can't be cleaned, so then the only way to... Then Libun Kal would be necessary. It would be necessary to heat it with a fire to the point of Kash Nisraf Me'achayrv, approximately 450, 500 degrees Fahrenheit. This would be very common when you have a container that's made, you have a kli that's made of multiple parts. For example, an oven with a knife with a separate handle, pots with separate handles. If the handle is so tight that it's impossible for any residue to get in between the handle and the blade, Hagola is enough. But you have to clean it till it's absolutely certain it's completely clean. Otherwise, Libun would be necessary. And on those plastic handles on your pot, they're not going to survive Libun. You'd have to take them off and clean it or come up with some other problem. It's a big... Things that are different parts are a big problem. But if you can get it completely clean, if there's no gap, it's okay. So that's important. We mentioned it has to be 24 hours since it was last used for treif. Or alternatively, you have to have at least 60 times the volume of the treifa spoon or whatever pot in the water. Mentioned under extenuating circumstances, it would be possible to use ammonia, bleach, something like that to make it pogum. There's a very, very important halacha that I think many people do not know in Agolas Kalim, and it's something that creates problems on a regular basis, from what I've seen, especially in commercial and industrial settings, is there's a halacha of chayis. There's a couple of places it comes up in Shulchan Aruch that if you were reading Shulchan Aruch, Mishneh Berurah, you might not realize the implications of this halacha. But I want to tell you, if you understand the reasons behind these, see from they're very, very relevant. Shulchan Aruch tells me that if you have a kli charis, you cannot do hagola or libun on it. Something of pottery, the bliyas never come out. The only way to do it would be to put it back in the kiln that was used to fire it when it was originally made, or a different kiln. Theoretically, if you would fill it up with coals, if you take a pottery pot and put glowing coals inside of it, that should be enough. However, you're not allowed to do that because we're worried that you won't do a proper job. You'll skimp on how many hot coals you'll put in because you're afraid the pot will crack. Now, between me and you, I don't have any pottery pots in my house. So I might think, well, it's irrelevant. There's another halacha. It says that if you have a knife, if you have a kli made out of ivory, or the knife that handles ivory, you can't do hagola on it. Why not? Not because it's like cheres, the bleeds would come out. But ivory is delicate. And if you would do hagola in boiling water, it might get ruined. So we're worried you're either going to make the water a little too cold, you're not going to put it all the way in, you'll take it out too quickly, and you won't do a good hagola on it. So these two things also, I don't personally do not have any ivory utensils in my house. However, it's very important. There is a yesoid here, there's a rule that it applies to any circumstance where a person is going to be concerned that by kashering their utensil they might ruin it. You're not allowed to kasher it, and if you did, b'dieved, you're not allowed to use it. And this would apply by many things. So for example, I was really going to mention it later, but let's say plastic. There's a machlokes on plastic, if plastic can be kashered at all. But even if is it like charis or is it like other things where the bleas do come out? However, even if charis can be kashered, if it's something that requires kashering in a boiling pot on the fire, there is concern that people will be reluctant because plastic can get ruined. If it's not heat-tempered plastic, it could get ruined, and a person might not do it properly. So in the end, if it's something that's not heat-resistant plastic, it can't be kashered. Another example that comes up on a regular basis, that comes up is, it's interesting, with doing libun. Not so much in a home, but let's say something is made out of steel and needs libun. Before I came, I was looking for it. I couldn't find it. I didn't bring it with me. But someone who works for the OU gave me research he did. There's many different types of steel. Steel is an alloy of iron and cotton and carbon and different other metals. And there are many different types of steel. We're familiar with stainless steel and whatever. But there are many, many different varieties of steel with slightly different compositions. Some of them are stronger but more brittle. Some are a little softer but they don't break as easily. Some are more heat resistant, some are less. But all of them, since they're alloys, they're mixtures of different metals, at a certain temperature they'll start to separate out and lose their strength. What temperatures damage steel? Roughly, all different, each variety is different, but 950 to 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit. What's the temperature we said for Libun Chomer? 900 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, to do a proper Libun means you have to get every single inch of this pot or whatever it is glow at 900 degrees Fahrenheit. Every single inch of it, if it has to get to that temperature. If you're taking your blowtorch and going inch by inch and getting it up to 900, are you going to be able to be careful you don't get it to 950? It's very risky. So that means that if a person's going to be constantly worried, I don't want to get it too hot because if I get it too hot I'm going to ruin it, or a mashgiach in a factory who's coming in to kasher their machinery and the owner's going to be looking over his shoulder saying, be careful, don't get it too hot, you're going to ruin my steamless machinery. So then it's a problem. It's a big problem kashering if you can kasher it at all. I remember when someone from the OU took me on a tour of the Hyatt Hotel in Manhattan. If I remember correctly, it's in the same building as Grand Central Station. And in the kitchen there, he showed us the grill. And he was explaining to us how careful you have to be to kasher the grill. The way they kasher the grill is they spread charcoal, glowing hot briquettes of charcoal all over the grill till the grill glows red hot. And that's how you get it up to the right temperature. But he explained to us you have to be very, very careful. Because they have a very sensitive fire protection system. They have a sprinkler system. If it gets above a certain temperature, it'll trigger the sprinklers. It'll alert the fire department. It'll shut down all of the water and electricity of the entire hotel. And it costs hundreds, if not thousands of dollars for the company to come down and reset the system. So you have to be very, very careful you don't make the grill too hot when you're doing it. So now you get into a very dakasdika situation. I mean, obviously the Rabbanim Machshirim there, who are big Talmidei Chachamim and Yerei Shemaim, allow him to kasher the grill. So we have to draw a line between. So I asked him, how can you do it? Why doesn't this fit into the Sif of Chais? So he explained to me. that, the way the Mashgiach explained it, I don't know if that, I did not ask Rav Belsky or Herschel Schachter their explanation. The way Mashgiach explained it is, he wanted to say there's a difference between being nervous and being careful. This is something you have to be careful. Shulchan Aruch is answering something that you're nervous about. I just want to point out it's a very fine line, and it's something that Vatikashus has to be very careful on their policy, how they're dealing with such an issue. I'm not coming to say that anyone's doing something wrong, but it's something that is that they have to be worried about. We as the consumer, I think, can rely on them if it's a good action, but it's something they have to be worried about. Fine. That was interesting. Another interesting thing that comes up on the Kibbalei Kachpolta issue is there's something called a spray dryer. Oh my God, I'm pretty pushing my time. Okay, so let's skip a spray dryer. It's not something that's going to come up to us. Microwaves we covered. Dishwashers is something people want to know. Can you kasher a dishwasher? So a lot of people are aware of the fact that Moshe has a couple of tshuvos where he does allow kashering a stainless dishwasher. Baruch Hashem, today most dishwashers are not enamel on the inside, they're stainless steel. So people might think, great, you can kasher dishwashers. But there's a problem, because Rav Moshe holds, at least, that you cannot kasher plastic. As we mentioned, there's a machlokes. But Rav Moshe holds you can't kasher plastic. Every dishwasher I've seen today, first of all, has plastic pieces. Whether it's where you add the salt, or where you add the detergents, whether it's the tracks that the runners go on, there are plastic parts there that, according to Rav Moshe, cannot be kashered, even if you run it on high, and even if you throw a glowing hot rock into your dishwasher, which I wouldn't really suggest either. There's an additional problem, practically speaking, is that every dishwasher I've seen has a trap, has a filter that catches particles. So you have to be sure that that is spotlessly clean. You have an issue, is there any possibility that you could have food residue down the piping, that the hot water will go down and then back up into the dishwasher. So while Reb Moshe's psak that the dishwasher theoretically can be kashered by running it on the hottest, practically speaking, it's not something I would recommend. Yes.
I know my dishwasher is a different Ashkenazi from Sephardic Post. At least Sephardic Post is more makeable regarding dishwashers. And Ashkenazi eating in a Sephardic house, that's an issue. I mean, can rely on, say, what to rely on. Is that an issue?
I just want to cover one or two other important points, since I think I'm really pretty much at the end of my time. But kashering countertops or tables, if necessary, is something. Now there's a couple of issues here also. Theoretically, a countertop, you'd say, you don't cook on the countertop. You don't put a countertop into a pot like a spoon. So what does a countertop have? It higher the maximum it should have is iri kli rishon. You may have spilled it onto your counter from a hot pot. So you should be able to just pour boiling water on your countertop. And that would be simple. But there's a couple issues here with the countertop. Number one is you have to make sure that it's spotlessly clean. To get the groove, the seam where it meets the wall, and especially where it meets the lip and where it meets the around the sink, is very difficult. It's difficult to do. So it's a practical consideration. If you can do it, great. There's another issue. Most shayish, to the best of my understanding, is not pure stone. Pure stone can be kashered by hagol. Shayish kesar, for example, which is ground up stone mixed with some kind of a adhesive, so that is going to have a din more like charis, more like pottery, which we mentioned, cannot be kashered. So even kesar pashas cannot be kashered. Regular standard shayish, whatever the standard shayish you're getting, you have to know. I've not researched it, but I've heard that most shayish is not pure stone. They have not cut these huge, long, thin slabs of granite out of the mountain. They have somehow processed smaller pieces of stone to stick them together, in which case the adhesive could potentially be problematic. That's really, if that's true, that's the biggest problem. So with the shayish, so therefore, for example, for Pesach, I wouldn't recommend someone kashering their countertop and not covering it. Once you're covering it, cover it with something that's strong enough, and then you don't need to kasher it. Some people have a chumer, they kasher and also cover, if that's your minhag, so you can do that, and then you don't really have to worry about all the reasons I'm saying to be concerned about kashering, because it's only a chumer anyway. Let's say, though, by mistake, tray for food spilled on your counter, or even more likely is, by mistake, milk, hot milk spilled on your fleshy counter the other way around. So now you're in a bedievadiga situation. I'd be reluctant to tell you that you have to replace your kitchen shayish and you can't kasher it. So the way, assuming we can get around the problem of not being pure stone, you would want, there's another issue here now. And the issue is, in addition to iri kli rishon, there potentially is dovar gush. I wish I had time to get into all the explanation, background of why dovar gush is more chomer, but for now you'll have to take my word for it, that a solid object that comes out of a klisheni and lands on your counter, out of a kli rishon and lands on your counter, according to many paiskim, retains the halach of a kli rishon and does not become a klisheni, and therefore iri would not be enough to take out the blias. And since that may have happened, we want to do agol in a kli rishon. Now you can't take your shayish and insert it in a boiling pot. So the best thing you can do, which is what you have to do according to the Ramah, not according to Mechaber, not for Sfaradim, is that you pour a boiling pot, a pot of boiling water on, and you simultaneously use a red hot rock or something similar to make sure that the water is boiling on the countertop. And then that is more or less equivalent to a true kli rishon. It is not the same as a kli rishon. Something that needs hagola in a kli rishon, it was something we know was primarily cooked in a kli rishon, that would not be enough to do iru with a red hot rock. But for a shayish where it's only an occasional maybe, there was a davar gush on it, it is enough. Fine, I did say I would cover, so I'm just going to very quickly run through what things you can and can't kasher. Metal is the classic. Metal can be kashered, whether it's hagola or libun. Wood can be kashered with hagola. Please don't do libun on wood. Plastic, and by extension formica, is a machlokes ha-poskim. Rav Moshe is machmir. Many poskim are meikel. Ask your rav what you should do. Let's see, what else is there? Glass, I think many people know, is a machlokes the mechaber Ramah. The Ramah is machmer, the considered glass. Well, let's just start. The classic thing you cannot kasher, as we mentioned passing a couple times, is cheres, pottery. You cannot get on all the bleeds. Glass is a machoikis. The machaber takes one extreme, is that it does not boilay at all and doesn't require kashering, just cleaning. The Ramah takes the opposite extreme, he's concerned that it might be like cheres. Ashkenazim are generally machmer for the Ramah. Some places can say that that's only for Pesach, not for Isser V'Hatter. Ask your Rav what you should do. But that's glass. Pyrex and Duralex, there are some people who are concerned that since it's not pure glass, there's other things added. Some people say there's boron added. It's a metal, so it should be like metal. Even the Mechaber should agree it needs Hagola. If you look into the chemical composition of glass, glass itself is only 72% silica. Duralex is 80%. So they both have other chemicals added to them. My personal opinion is, therefore, that since they're both primarily silica, and it's only a minor difference in the other minerals added, that there is not a significant difference. Many places can hold that way. Ask your Rav what you should do. But my opinion is that Duralex, Pyrex are essentially the same as glass. And in a circumstance where glass can be kashered, then Pyrex could also. I think we've covered... China is that porcelain is a big machlokes ha-paiskim. It goes back way back, and it's generally accepted not to kasher on a regular basis under extenuating circumstances. Ask your rav. Any other guy? I think I covered all the important points. Anyone who has other questions can ask me afterwards. But I want to just release anyone who it's been enough because I already spoke over my hour, and I'll answer as many questions as you want afterwards.
Let me just officially. Close this year, and Rob's willing to stay because I'd hate. I'd like to thank those of you who attended again. Next week, in Yitzhak Hashem, is Rav Moshe Flumenbaum, who will be addressing Inyanei Stam. He'll be speaking about Sefer Torah, Mezuzahs, things that are going on in the Shuk, things to worry about, things that we should look for. For me personally, I'd like to thank Rav Manosh, and I think at the very least, everyone should have understood A, kashering is serious business. I know for the few times I was privileged enough to take part in different hotel settings, it's a very humbling experience to see how much the Rabbanim know, halacha l'maisa and halacha, what's involved, and it's a very humbling experience to realize how badly people can get burnt and messed up and destroy expensive equipment. So before you start trying to cast your home, you really need, I mean it, you really, really need to know what you're doing. It's a serious business. Chas v'shalom, you could try to cast you something and land out in a medical emergency. Anyway, I'd like to thank Rav Manos and those that want to stay and go for the questions as long as he can deal with it. B'simcha.